Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
Texas is a dramatic and sometimes terrible place. From the shooting at a Colleen Luby's and the siege of the Branch Davidian compound to the breakup of the Space Shuttle Columbia and the attacks at Fort Hood, journalists who cover the state have witnessed and recounted great sorrow. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Today I'm joined by two journalists who have personally reported on many of the most intense and unforgettable stories in modern Texas history. John McKay is anchor for WFAA-TV. Wade Goodwin is a national correspondent for NPR. Both are panelists in a JFK symposium tonight called Covering Tragedy, Journalism in a Changing World. Produced in partnership with the Fort Worth Opera and the Sixth Floor Museum, the event is one in a series of discussions leading up to JFK, a world premiere opera at the Fort Worth Opera Festival this spring. You can find information at fwopera.org. We'll also be streaming tonight's sold-out event at keranews.org. Gentlemen, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
By its nature, most breaking news, the stuff that can't be predicted in advance, is bad news. What draws you to this work, knowing that often you will be interviewing people under great stress on the worst day of their lives?
Well, I don't know that I'm drawn to it. It's part of the deal you get when you become a reporter. I've been doing this a long time, and when I get that call, I still get this feeling in my stomach. It's a dread, really. I mean, it's mixed in with excitement, but covering other people's horror and misery is painful. And it doesn't matter how much scab you build over your own skin; it's always painful. And tornadoes and war, or a blown up building in Oklahoma City, or a burning down building in Waco. They're all different, but they all have terrible elements of sadness and tragedy and defensiveness. School shootings, gosh.
Yeah.
I can tell you that's really the worst, I think, because it makes the entire community feel bad about itself, even though the community really has no responsibility at all for what has happened. And each one has its own particular brand or taste of horror, I think. And over time, you learn what these are. But I don't know that it's something that draws me to the work.
Yeah, I can't say that that draws me. I think that what I'm concerned about always is in every case like this, there's not just accurate information, there's also false information. And there you learn quite quickly that there's a difference between something that's accurate and something that's actually the truth. There really is a difference between the two. And so what you're trying to do is navigate for your audience, for your viewers or listeners or readers. You're trying to give them some idea of what really is going on, why it's important, why it's significant, and who the real players are in this. Because you can make some very serious mistakes, and if you make a mistake in this in something live, then you've got nothing but problems that you're going to have to deal with for several days, maybe even weeks on.
How important do you find it to correct the mistakes that other news organizations are making? Because there are certain times when you know something to be true and it's being falsely reported elsewhere. And do you have to acknowledge that in order to tell the complete story to your audience?
Well, I think you have to acknowledge anything that's not accurate. If you're going to report on an event, and you don't have to necessarily say so-and-so said such and such, but what you have to say is there are media reports that say this, but the actual fact is this and this and this based upon what we've heard from these individuals. So I think that the correction of the public record is a requirement for just about any kind of journalist, no matter what field you're in.
Well, I think you say there are reports about this, but NPR does not have this confirmed. And so you warn, it might be true, but not true. And we don't know that it's for certain. And you, by doing so, I think you communicate to your, for us, the listener, that we're being careful here.
Mm-hmm.
And so that what you are going to hear us report is something that we have checked out and now know it's true. You know, we have made some awful mistakes in the past, and one of the worst was the shooting of Gabby Gifford. NPR reported that the congresswoman had died, and obviously that was not true. But it cast a pall over a lot of really wonderful coverage that a lot of reporters are doing. And it also taught us, I mean, after we had made that awful mistake, that is when, you know, inside of Washington, the editors and the producers began to put together a way of handling these kinds of things so that this didn't happen again. Because I think before it was a little haphazard. But now that's not true at NPR anymore. We have editors, we call them the standards editor, and they have to approve when, you know, we're about to report on something that no one else has got yet. And until we are dead certain that we are correct, we hold it. And it may mean that someone else is going to report it first, but we've decided we're going to do that instead.
Yeah, I mean, here is the danger for me. There's something that's live on. You're in front of a TV camera. You're talking live to people. And all of a sudden you're told, hey, so-and-so has just joined us. They're on the scene. They live across the street. And that person may not necessarily – if they called you, you're not really sure who that person is.
Right.
Do you want to put that person on the air? Has that person been vetted? Anything that they tell you, is that information accurate? Even if they do live across the street, how good a viewer, how good an observer is that individual? That's why I say, I mean, every single second you're on, you have to be thinking about what is it that people need to know, that I know to be accurate, or at least we're moving in the proper direction to try to figure out exactly what's going on.
I was watching coverage after the Boston Marathon attacks when they were looking for the suspects and believed they had centered, they had found the individuals or knew where they were, and there were journalists from all over. It wasn't NPR coverage and it wasn't WFAA coverage. It might have been CNN, but I could tell that the reporter who was out there was under great pressure to produce some information that wasn't possible to obtain in the moment. There were barricades. What can you tell us about balancing that pressure from your editors, from your viewers and listeners who want more information when, in fact, the information isn't available to you yet or can't be verified?
Well, anytime this starts, all you have is you. Even today, with all the technology, all you really have is you. So you've been told that an incident has occurred. Pardon me. So you come on the air and you start talking about the information that you do have, but you try to put it in such a way that people know that this is a story that is developing. So you say, we've gotten an indication that there's been, for example, an explosion at such and such a location. Those of you who know the area know that there are people who live in this general. So you're trying the whole time to try to narrow the information to things that you know to be accurate based upon the past. And slowly but surely, as the information comes in, as pictures come in, as more reporters are added, that sort of thing, as witnesses who are vetted come in, you're able to use them to refine the basic facts that you've started off with. So to me, that's what the key is. You go with what you know, and you build brick by brick from that. And the problem is, again, if you get some false information, you've got to not just take out that brick. You've got to take out the things that are around that, where that information came from. So it can be difficult, but you have to be very careful in all that you do.
I think the worst, you know, words that an NPR reporter can hear is that the New York Times is reporting.
Because that means find out if it's true or not.
Correct.
And get it on our air.
And also I'm chasing a New York Times reporter's story instead of getting my own story. Mm-hmm. And so you have to have those conversations in the moment, which is, do you really want me to stop doing what I'm doing now so that I can go chase another reporter's report and to see if that's true? And then if you put it that way, then they have to think about it for a moment. At NPR, we have a very strange kind of amalgamation. We have the shows, mm-hmm. which is Morning Edition and All Things Considered. And then we have the news desks, the national desk, the foreign desk, the science desk, the cultural desk. And these are the desks that feed the shows, the stories that – the shows can also do their own stories. But so you'll get tension inside the network between the shows who are reading everything they can see – and then the reporters who are out there in the field who are chasing what they're chasing. And, you know, I mean, NPR is a very robust news gathering organization. But, you know, we frankly don't have the kind of reporting strength the Times can throw at a story. I mean, there'll be four of us and 18 New York Times reporters on a major story. So I think that's, you know, that's part of what you have to cope with is you have to follow your own nose, I think, when you're doing this. Not chase other people's stories. It's because really, then what do we have? Then I'm confirming what another news organization has already broken when, in fact, I could be breaking something else for us. So, and all of that, let me tell you, these are very heated conversations in the midst of breaking news because we want to be right up there with the New York Times. We want to be right up there with all the best news gathering organizations. I mean, there was a time when we were all things considered, and that was back in the early days.
One deadline per day.
That's right. And what really changed that was, I think, the bombing in Oklahoma City. That was the first time NPR began to see itself as a primary news source for our listeners, as opposed to an alternative news source, all things considered. I mean, it was built into our name, right? But after that, we began to think, you know what, we are going to play with the big boys from now on. And that was really a seminal moment.
Yeah. Now, for what I do, for example, at WFAA, you have to also take into consideration the visual aspect and the visual, a live picture. I'll give you a good example. Remember, we just had back last year when the police department, the headquarters, was attacked by an individual. Well, they woke me up in the middle of the night to come down. Well, when you're looking at a helicopter that can actually give you a live picture, you not only have to wonder about what the picture is telling you, you have to wonder about what is the picture telling you that you really don't want some people to know. For example, a live camera can also show you where a sniper is positioned on a building. Well, do you really want to send that picture out to people? Because it's not just the regular audience looking at this. Also, maybe the person with the gun watching this. So you have to be ready to say to the person who's behind the camera, "Hey, can we zoom in a little bit? There's something," and you have to tell people, "Look, there's some things we're not going to show you because we don't want these police officers, these firefighters, these law enforcement individuals to be injured, pardon me, as well." So those are the things. Again, it's not just getting accurate information. It's making sure that the information that you give to people isn't going to have some situation cause some situations that are going to cause even more problems down the road.
And of course, Wade, you have the challenge. You don't have pictures to tell the story. You have to create them with your words, and you want them to be very descriptive, but you never want to go over the line into editorializing.
Well, there is a line there. I probably push it. I think that not having the pictures frees us. I mean, TV is so tied to the video, it's a girdle on them. It's a girdle we're free from, and I think that helps us. We have sound, but the sound is nowhere near as important to NPR as the pictures are to WFAA. And so we're freer to roam and look at things that, you know, encompass the whole story there. So, I think that it's a good question. I mean, some of my most vivid reporting really pushes the boundary of where you're rubbing up against putting yourself into the story, but I'm okay with that. I mean, I'm kind of okay as long as I'm telling people why I think what I think.
Okay, let me jump in here. We have to take a break. My guests are Wade Goodwin of NPR and John McKay of WFAA. We'll be back to this conversation about covering tragedy in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now for the Doctor of Liberal Studies degree beginning in the fall of 2016. A customizable evening graduate program for working professionals. More at smu.edu/GLS.
At 3:01 Monday afternoon, the National Weather Service issued a very rare tornado emergency for the Oklahoma City area, a warning that widespread damage and fatalities were likely. A tornado had dropped out of the sky and was bearing down on a suburb south of town. The tornado started small and rope-like, but in a matter of minutes grew more than a mile wide, then a mile and a half, astonishing the storm chasers following it. As sirens began to scream in the town of Moore, people had but a few minutes to find their safest spot, hunker down, and wait. William Brown, an Iraqi war vet, his wife, and his next-door neighbor and her daughter all ran to Brown's storm cellar.
I saw the horizontal rain from the wraparound, and I knew it was about to get us. And then you heard, then all your common stuff started happening, all the train sound and the screeching and of metal and mud started coming into the tornado shelter, so I knew the garage was gone. And I could smell gas, so I knew that my car was probably gone.
The Browns' house was destroyed, as was their neighborhood, but because they were on the edge of the tornado's path and because they had a storm shelter, their lives were saved.
It took everything out, but that's what insurance is for. And everybody's okay, and that's what's important.
200-mile-an-hour winds plowed a deadly trough through town. If your house or school or business were in the monster's path, there was precious little you could do to save yourself but pray. Homes were
swept up. That's Wade Goodwin, NPR National Desk Correspondent covering Texas and the surrounding states. He's my guest this hour, along with John McKay, anchor at WFAA. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So much going on in that story, Wade. And obviously, you arrived on the scene after the terrible events had taken place. Can you talk a little bit about how you get on the ground and get your bearings and begin to unravel a story from all of this?
Well, that one was hard because that tornado had hit the airport, and they'd closed down I-35. I'm sure WFAA knows this. So I had to make a decision. Do I drive or do I go to the airport? And I decided I'm going to go to the airport and wait for them to open so I can get up there, because while I was at the airport, I could continue to report the story, which I did on my iPad. I opened it up, and I started following the local TV station's helicopters.
Yeah, I was going to say,
and I was watching it all unfold at Love Field. And I was, you know, I was at Love Field, but really I was inside the local TV station's helicopters. So all the descriptions you're seeing are eyewitness descriptions from me via the local TV helicopters that are chasing these. And you know, so this is me taking advantage of the amazing technology that has been developed by local TV news. And then as I started to watch it, I began to call the Oklahoma City public radio station and say, all right, here's what I think I'm going to need. If anybody can get in there, you know, see if we can find some people who've – and, of course, they did. And so that tape you hear is them talking to the local station reporter, not to me. And if you listen, my voice, my voice is so tired. It's 3:30 or 4 in the morning. I'm in an Oklahoma City hotel room. And I'm filing this piece for Morning Edition, having gathered all the strings from they've sent their stuff to me, and I put it all together in that hotel room and wrote it. You know, there's some imagery that comes at the end of the piece that has to do with me flying in into Oklahoma City finally, and I can see out the window the tornadoes moving east. And then on the other side, I can see more flashes of thunderstorm that's heading toward Moore again, because it's not finished yet.
Yeah.
And so I took all of that and put it into that story, which really, you know, ended up sounding like I'd been, you know, chasing that tornado myself. But it really was a group effort.
I will say your tired voice is pretty robust, Wade.
Thank you. Thank you. And which I think points out a key part of this breaking news coverage. A lot of the times you listen to people, and if you listen to the – Wade and I were talking about this earlier – the excitement in their voice, the excitement makes you feel that they may not be sensitive to the damage, the destruction, the terror, the fear that's underway. And in his voice, what you got was a sense of – how it should be, what is going on, the fact that people are tired, that they're devastated by what's happened. So that's a very deft touch that only comes, I think, after you've been doing this for a while. Because there are some people who would, it's just another story, and there's just more people injured, and that's a sad thing. But you hear that quite often on a lot of different stories and breaking news.
John, from your perspective, how important is it in stories when you're in the studio, you're not sent out to actually report on them? How much do you think of your role as being someone who helps people stay calm?
I always think of it that way. That is the first thing. That is the first thing that goes through my mind. When we have a breaking news that happens at 3 o'clock, the first thing I think about is what about if it's in the city? I remember once in Fort Worth, we had something had happened in North Fort Worth. And we had breaking news. Children were being let out of school. And I remember saying to myself as we were on the air, what about the sixth grader who's sitting at home? Mom and dad aren't there. How can we tell this story without making that sixth grader seem terrified? I mean, there has to be some way to explain this to people where you say, this is dangerous. This is an unusual situation, but things are under control. So I think you can use your voice. You can use the narration. You can use the picture to try to give people a clear understanding that something more than that doesn't normally happen has occurred. But we still have things relatively under control, or we have some idea. The right people are in place or moving in the direction to bring it under control. That is, to me, the key thing that the anchor person should do. Now, some might argue that you're not telling people the full truth. I get that all the time. And what you're really trying to do is, I think, to a degree, keep people relatively calm in sometimes dangerous situations, because you can get carried away if you want to, and I don't want to be a part of that.
And there, of course, are cases where people are more frightened than they necessarily need to be. And I'm thinking about, people were very concerned about the discovery that the Ebola virus, an active case of the Ebola virus, had come to North Texas. The relative risk to the average resident of this area was incredibly low, but it didn't feel that way for a lot of people.
Well, it didn't feel that way. And there were circumstances in which people in the positions of authority certainly didn't do things to make people calm. At least I don't think. I think that there were a lot of people who did their best to try to calm people down. What comes to mind first is the Dallas County Judge Clay Jenkins. There were a number of people who really went out of their way to try to calm people. But we had folks, particularly, you may have noticed this too, when the reporters from out of town came in, all of a sudden the words they were using, the people with whom they were talking, all were individuals who I'm looking at and going, I understand what you're saying, but we're not about to go there, because we don't have evidence to back up the fear that you're trying to tell people that we have across this city. So you have to walk a fine line between giving people the information that's necessary and not making it something that's sensationalized.
Well, let's talk Katrina and Rita. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Katrina was a hurricane that trapped New Orleans because people in New Orleans had seen so many hurricanes that were bearing down on New Orleans and then veered off east in the last few hours. And indeed, that's what Katrina did do. It veered off east. And at first we thought New Orleans has been spared again. But actually New Orleans had not been spared again. And so all what happened to New Orleans was, searingly impressed upon everybody's brain. And then when Rita came 2 weeks later, Houston was bearing down on Galveston and Houston. And the entire city of Houston and Galveston tried to get out, having learned their lesson from New Orleans. And then that created a nightmare on the highways where – thousands of people were trapped and they ran out of gas. And, it was a man-made mess then. And I don't know that the news coverage, you know, was responsible in any way. I think there was the folks in New Orleans were going to do what they were going to do. And then after that happened, the people in Houston were not going to have that happen to them again. Yeah. And they tried to get out. But Texas wasn't ready to deal with trying to evacuate a city of several million people. And so they all got stuck. And so it's hard to – these stories have a power of their own that exist outside the way we report them.
Inevitably, you and your colleagues will have to leave the stories that you're covering before they're over for the subjects of those stories. What you know is tied up in a nice package for listeners or for viewers or for readers is just the beginning of recovery for people who've been affected. How are decisions made about when a story, for purposes of news coverage, is finished?
Well, the most recent, I think, major stories that I can think of in this area would be the tornadoes that hit during the Christmas season in Garland and Rowlett. And we're still reporting on those. What we're reporting on are the facts that people are still having problems getting any kind of money for their individual losses. The cities are having difficulties. What's going on in terms of the process of making improving the city? So those things happen, I think, on a day-to-day basis. What we usually find is the reporter comes back and says, hey, I met this family, and this family has been living there for two generations. They lost everything. Their agent is coming to see them tomorrow or next week. Well, if you're a reporter, you want to be there for that story because that's the kind of thing people connect to, I think. And so what you try to do is find the natural moment when that story seems to have come to an end. It's not just that the storms have left or the fire is over. It's also that the people have been, to a degree, put on a path where they can go back to where they were before. And that varies from story to story.
I don't do it enough. I mean, I need to remind myself that I need to go back and pick up these threads and report on them because people like it. People want to know. Let's take the town of West and the fertilizer plant explosion there. I mean, that was a very interesting story because the fact is that the town had a very sober and clear-eyed way of seeing what had happened, and that was before the town of West grew out there, the fertilizer plant was there first, 50 years before the town had grown out that far. And so they weren't going to blame the fertilizer plant or the fertilizer plant owner for what had happened. But the fact is that some very brave young firefighters lost their lives because they had no idea what they were getting into. They saw a fire. They did what they thought they'd been trained to do, which is to put water on it. But putting water on a fertilizer fire was the wrong thing to do, and they did not know it. There was a Dallas police captain mm-hmm. who happened to live there, who ran out there, and who tried to call them back. And before he could do that, the place blew up. He lost his life in attempting to save these young firefighters. But he knew that what they were doing was the wrong thing because he'd been trained. He wasn't a volunteer. He was a professional firefighter. And I think what Texas has done since that time has been a shameful dereliction of legislative duty in that we have not passed laws that have allowed these firefighters to get the training or to go into these places and look at them like they need to or to hold these chemical plants and fertilizer plants accountable because we're in Texas and we don't want to regulate. So we've gone back and kind of covered the legislature, but I think there's – the problem for Texas, the problem for NPR in Texas is such a great news state. I mean, it's the gift that keeps on giving. And so,
for better or for worse.
Yeah, for better.
And I'm always on to the next thing. Yeah. I mean, I have such a plate full of story ideas. It's all I can do to get to the next one. So the idea that I should go back, well, that doesn't seem, but I should. I should go back.
Yeah, I mean, we do try to go back. Just speaking of the plant itself, I remember Brett Shipp, one of our investigative reporters, went down and pointed out to people, pointed out to state officials what the problems were, and was met with this kind of stony-faced silence. Of, well, we didn't know, or we're not sure, or that sort of thing. And we still have in place problems that he has pointed out, and I think only in the last couple of weeks have I heard any kind of discussion about, well, maybe we need to change this or change that. We also, a year after this occurred, David Schechter, who works for us, and a series of photographers and producers and editors worked on a documentary on West to go back to it. They took a look at West through an entire year. So in that aspect, in that instance, I think we did a pretty good job of trying to button up what's the beginning of this, what's the end of this. I'm the person who had to do the initial breaking news coverage of that. When you're standing in front of a camera, and there are the only picture that we had that night was from our helicopter looking down from, because remember, the firefighters, most of them couldn't get there. The road was backed up. Our helicopter looking down, and you could see the flames way off in the distance. That's all we knew, plus the people we were trying to talk to on the telephone. And that went on probably for a half an hour. From that part until the very end, and we're still down there from time to time covering different things that go on there. So that's, I think that's a case where we probably did the things that we should do. But Wade's right. Should we go back for more of them? Absolutely. It'd be great because that's what people want to hear and see.
Many people are very excited about what can be learned via social media. I think a lot of veteran journalists are also concerned about verifying, the veracity of what's there. What kinds of conversations? Actually, we're about to come up to a break here, but think about that question. The kinds of conversations that you and your colleagues have about how appropriate it is to rely on social media to get a sense of what's happening in a breaking story. We're speaking this hour with John McKay, anchor of WFAA-TV, and Wade Goodwin, reporter for NPR. Both are panelists in a JFK symposium presented tonight by the Fort Worth Opera in partnership with the Sixth Floor Museum and KERA. The title of this is Covering Tragedy, Journalism in a Changing World. Tonight's program is sold out, but you can check it out online at kera.org. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Graduate Liberal Studies Program. You can apply now to design your own doctoral or master's degree at SMU, specializing in organizational dynamics, human rights, and more. Details at smu.edu/GLS.
There was no warning, a smiling reporter on the air during her last live report of the morning.
We're seeing tourism.
Gunned down along with her photographer. Colleagues at WDBJ in Roanoke, viewers, and other local news teams watched in horror. Police rushing to the scene to find reporter Allison Parker and news photographer Adam Ward dead. Vicki Gardner, the woman they were interviewing, seriously injured. Authorities quickly zeroed in on 47-year-old former WDBJ reporter Vester Flanagan, known on air as Bryce Williams. A Virginia State Trooper spotted the suspect, gave chase before Flanagan crashed. He later died at the hospital from a self-inflicted gunshot wound. In an eerie twist, Flanagan had called ABC News and faxed a letter explaining the Charleston church shooting was his tipping point.
That's John McKay reporting in August about the on-air shootings of two Virginia journalists. We're speaking this hour with WFAA anchor John McKay and Wade Goodwin, who's a national correspondent for NPR. We're talking about covering tragedy. And it's interesting that we happen to have this clip because, of course, John, this was a story that people were immediately responding to on social media, some of whom might have had accurate information, many of whom did not.
Interesting. You know, also who was on social media at that time was the shooter himself. Mm-hmm. He was, I believe, exchanging information with the people on what was going on. If I remember that story correctly, as it unfolded, at first people were saying, hey, this has to be this other individual, who it turns out was not the shooter. And some cases, these people were naming this person. And people, as they seek to be first, journalists, as they seek to be first, have to be careful with the fact that, yeah, this person may say this, they may have worked with this individual, but if it goes over our air, over our airwaves, we're the ones who are going to be held accountable for that, if it's not accurate. So you have to be very careful with what's going on. While you're trying to be first, my contention has always been, I would much rather be right than first, because there are plenty of people, as Wade just pointed out just a little while, who've tried to be first with something, and it turns out they're wrong. And once you're wrong, you've got to fix not just the wrong, but the things that led up to the wrong. And you don't really want to be a part of that, if at all possible.
That story, you know, we were talking about TV kind of being tied to the video and how it can be limiting, but that showed the power of the video. I mean, I just remember the horror and I couldn't stop watching, having seen those clips. And then having seen the clips, you know, you can't help but put yourself into that situation and think, gosh, you know.
How many early morning live shots? How many?
Oh, yes.
Or
oh,
just,
yes.
I mean, how cruel fate can be. I mean, these two people had done nothing at all. They weren't even really connected to the shooter. They were just people who had gone out on a live shot that the shooter happened to know about. Which I'm kind of moving far afield here, but I mean, different tragedies can have different elements to them, and that tragedy was so TV-centric because it was a TV reporter who was murdered on air, and plus the romances that had been going on inside the newsroom, it was all just so, you know, young people, and they're so tragic.
Yeah, I mean, we never aired the full pictures of what actually the full video of what actually happened, where the person actually walks up and commits this act. We never aired that full thing, but it got on. It's on social. It was on social media. It's shared again and again and again, and then people get mad at you when you don't show the entire thing. But you have to again walk this line that gives people the information, the accurate information, gives them the sense of what happened without. In any kind of way, going over a line that you really can't point out as that's the exact line.
It's interesting to me that in this country we tend to shy away from any kind of visual depiction of a dead body. And if it happens overseas, you see it much more often. And I've wondered about that and why, not just journalists, but why as a society we feel like it's okay to draw the line there, that it's, you know, to see bodies in Syria is somehow not upsetting to American audiences the way it is to see bodies that are American.
Yeah, I you can see that quite a bit. As news coverage and news organizations become more international in what they do, now we have CCTV, we have two kinds of CNN, the BBC. You can watch all of these and get a sense of what goes on. And even within the network itself, see different standards. The question for us at WFA has always been, we don't like to show bodies, no matter where they are.
Why?
And we don't do that simply because we think that our audience isn't used to that. In this country, I lived in Spain for 6 years before I went to college, but this was Franco Spain, so they didn't even talk about things like that. So every country, every community, actually, I think the standards in Dallas, for example, may be different than the standards in, say, New York City or Los Angeles. And so you have to have some understanding of what it is that you think your audience will accept. I covered the deaths of four children in a fire many years ago in Arlington. They were all dead in fire of smoke inhalation. The family asked us to come to the funeral. It's unusual that four children die. The youngest child was 5 years old. I mean, the oldest child was 5 years old. I remember going early, this is at St. Maria Goretti in Arlington, and asking the pastor of the church, where can we shoot where we're not going to get in anybody's way? And he said, he pointed out a spot up on the balcony. So we went up there and shot. Well, this family happened to be from Mexico. And a crew had come in from Mexico, unbeknownst to us, and during the funeral actually walked up and shot pictures of the coffins themselves. right there during the service. Well, and that's because these are just different aspects of how things are covered. If we did that, I think it would cause more than a little bit of a surprise because people are just not used to that kind of thing. We believe here that the story can be covered and covered accurately and fairly without having to do that sort of thing.
Sometimes this can be driven by the reporter. I'll tell the story of James Byrd Jr., a black man who was chained to the back of a pickup truck in East Texas and pulled behind the road until he was dead. And when the medical exam, I covered the trial of the first accused, and when the medical examiner testified, I used that as the vehicle to explain what had happened to Byrd. And so, in a very matter-of-fact tone of voice, I just wrote what the medical examiner had testified to and how parts of the poor Mr. Byrd had come off, you know, as he was chained and drugged. And it went out on Morning Edition. And this was, of course, before we had the standards editor. And it absolutely, you know, internally blew the place up because Morning Edition was furious. You know, we have people trying to eat breakfast here. And then there was a backlash from the black staff at NPR saying this is exactly what Wade Goodwin should be reporting because this is the kind of stuff that brings home to people, you know, what can happen to black people, you know, sometimes.
We're not going to make this story go with your pancakes.
Right. Well, so, I mean, and so there is, and I do think that part of what you're seeing in Syria are foreign correspondents who are grieving at the extent of the desolation and death and then therefore lobbying to put some of this stuff on to snap us out of our little cocoons of happiness here.
Yes.
It's a negotiation that goes on constantly, I think, between reporters and editors about, you know, how much of the ugliness do we let in.
How much do you think about the effect that your reporting will have on the subjects of your reporting? The fact that, you know, appearing in a story on WFAA or giving you an interview, Wade, will have repercussions for the person that you've spoken to.
No, I think you think of that all the time. You wonder whether or not – anytime you see an interview, for example, that's in silhouette, that must have been done because you're concerned about the person with whom you're doing the interview. Because when you do the interview for television, that person's not in silhouette. You have to do that later. So even if you have made the agreement that we're going to try to cover up your identity, clearly you have some concerns about the individual with whom you're talking. So and it depends upon the story. It depends upon their involvement in the story, where they stand, those kinds of things. But those considerations are taken, I think, by a lot of people. It just depends upon who they are and what they contribute to the program, the story itself.
Well, at NPR, we have pretty strict standards on who gets to be anonymous. They have to be afraid for their life or afraid for their livelihood.
Mm-hmm.
I just did a story that looked at the effect that the abortion battle in Texas had not on women's ability to get abortion, but on women's ability in Texas to access family planning clinics, because 82 family planning clinics in Texas have closed down as a result of the abortion restrictions passed by the legislature. And the last person I had in the piece was a young woman from Lubbock who had tried to get birth control and had had a very unhappy experience at the Texas Tech student clinic and then called the county clinic and was told, well, we'll see you in 4 months. And she didn't want to wait 4 months to try to get birth control. This was her first time to have sex. And so the two Planned Parenthood clinics that had been in Lubbock closed down, so she was forced to travel to Fort Worth. And they said, yes, come on down. And she was not met with any judgment by the Planned Parenthood clinic, but she asked to remain anonymous. And the reason was, and we explained it in the piece, was because of what had happened in Colorado Springs, that which was really not that far from Lubbock. And she was afraid that if she came out as a fervent supporter of Planned Parenthood living in West Texas, that there might be repercussions for her. And so we allowed her to remain anonymous. But we had to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
How have your jobs shaped your view of human nature?
Well, I think most people are good people. I really do. But clearly there are individuals who are beyond the pale in terms of what they them not caring about people around them, that sort of thing. I tend to think that most people know right from wrong. That's why when they do the wrong, they do it where nobody else can see it. But they know deep down that they've done something that's wrong. So in my view, it shaped me that way. That a lot of and the problem is, you see so much where people say one thing and you know they've done something else. That when there is somebody who's telling the truth, sometimes you miss that. And you're kind of surprised by the fact that this person is so innocent, they really are telling me the truth. You can hear when I hear reporters say that, you know, the guy's really telling the truth. That it doesn't happen often, but you're kind of shocked that that happens because we are around so many people that will say one thing and really do another, or they'll say something and you know that that's not what happened.
And that's why it's so important for reporters to do their own reporting.
Yep.
Because it's in the process of setting up the interviews and doing the interviews and meeting the people that you begin to get a sense of who they are and what they're like. And we've seen, you know, so many times with network news where they have producers who go out and do the pre-interviews, and then you get the on-air talent comes in and kind of does the interview and puts their face on mm-hmm. And then it all goes awry. And you know, they're like, well, I just kind of showed up to do the questions and be the face on the camera. Veteran reporters over time develop a nose. So that when a reporter says, this person's telling the truth, it's because their nose has told them that this person – or you start to think, there's something hinky here.
Yep.
This guy is not – I don't know about this guy. And just that little seed of doubt, you learn if you're a veteran reporter to trust that, and then you start to look deeper because you don't want to be had.
No.
Because if you're had, then that's you – that's your fanny. That's been that's out on the line there. So I think that's one of the great things about being an NPR reporter. You have to go out with a microphone, stick a microphone in somebody's face. You know, newspaper reporters, they do a lot of reporting on the phone, and it's different. I mean, when you go to a neighborhood or you go to somebody's house, you get to see. You get a whole nother deeper sense of what the situation is, and it helps ground you. It helps ground your reporting.
Do you all pay attention to news when you're on vacation, or do you disconnect?
Oh, I wish my wife was here.
That's a no, then, right? You don't disconnect.
Oh, no, I don't disconnect. I'm good for about 3 or 4 days, and then. You just have to see what's going on. I mean, and that becomes the little thing. For I can't stand it when someone comes to me and says, "Hey, you're from Texas. I just heard such and such happened 2 days ago." And if it's something you don't know because you've been on vacation, well, it will just eat me to death that I don't know about that. And so I'll check around till I find out. I mean, I'm bad about flipping from one channel to another, flipping from one radio station to another. So you got to watch yourself.
John McKay is an anchor for WFAA-TV. Wade Goodwin is national correspondent for NPR. We'll continue this conversation this evening in a panel discussion called Covering Tragedy, Journalism in a Changing World. It's produced in partnership with the Fort Worth Opera and the Sixth Floor Museum, part of a series of discussions leading up to the JFK World Premiere Opera at the Fort Worth Opera Festival this spring. Gentlemen, it's been wonderful to have you both here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy, with help on the phone today from Kristen Taylor. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.